Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. The Cleveland Cavaliers are down 0-2 to the Golden State Warriors. Mental gaffes and just general Warriors play have put the Cavs in a hole. And now they go back to Cleveland looking to hold serve. To break everything down with me, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how's it going, buddy?
It's good. I'm glad we waited till game two to pod because I think game one would have just been a lot of sobbing.
You were pretty mad online.
I was mad online, but sad inside.
Yeah.
I haven't been so sad about a loss, I think, ever. I don't think I've ever been more upset about a loss that I just, like, that was, like, partially taken away, partially given away, like, all the confluences of events. I'm still not all the way over it. Like, I just spent that whole game, too, and I don't know if you felt this way, but I spent the whole game, too, just thinking, like, that's why you can't lose game one. That's why you can't give that game away. Just can't. That's why.
Honestly, that was my reaction immediately after that game. I was like, well, game two is going to be the we're not fucking around game from the Warriors. And in many ways, it was. In many ways, it was, but I still think that the Warriors came out with the focus in game two, but I think they didn't exactly have sustained focus. Steph certainly put it away towards the end of the game, and they kind of turned on the Jets there, but it wasn't like they were going out all out the entire game. But yeah, game one felt like, okay, there was your chance to make this a 5 or 6 game series instead of a 4 or 5. And to position yourselves to maybe capitalize in case if the Warriors fall apart or if injuries happen, things like that. But the absurdity of how they lost game one, like it's kind of like when you watch one of those annoying movies where everything just goes wrong, like a Chevy Chase movie. And it's like everything adds up. And I was just kind of sitting there like almost laughing because I'm like, it's just so absurd. There's too many painful factors here to actually get upset, you know what I mean.
I couldn't disagree more because I got very upset. I don't know. I do want to talk about game two because I thought even though the Warriors avalanched them, there were significant stretches here where the Cavs did really good work. And I think that's worth talking about. I think that what was really interesting was I think the Warriors completely threw the Cavs for a loop with all these slipped screens. And this is something that I've been talking about since 2016 about when teams are switching on you. One of the best ways to beat that is to slip that screen before there's contact even made.
Right.
Because if your screener has any playmaking skill whatsoever, they have a free run.
Yeah, and that was actually one of the reasons why I was concerned. I tweeted before the game that I was concerned about having JaVale McGee in there. Part of that was influenced by how he played in game one. And it's funny. Yes, McGee went 6 for 6, but at the same time, he somehow managed to have a plus minus of 0, which is pretty typical JaVale McGee. And the amount of times that the Cavs leave him open, he's basically his defense against himself. Like, the plays where he converts are plays where he doesn't trip over his own feet or like punch the ball out of bounds or block himself with the rim. But the Cavs just aren't defending him well at all.
No, they weren't. But I will say, so obviously the Warriors came out with that, which was like terrifying murder. I think they hit like 11 of their first 13 shots. The Cavs hung around and then they started getting a little tighter on those switches. Yeah, like JaVale got a couple more buckets, but it wasn't devastating. And the Cavs were able to run some pretty good offense. I thought George Hill was really, really good in this game.
I would agree.
I thought that Kevin Love was awful early, but then kind of found his rhythm a little bit in the second half.
He was never passive, though. Like, sorry to cut you off, but that's the nice thing. And I think you did see a lot of resilience from the Cavs in this game, whether it be individually, like Love continuing to battle, or just every time the Warriors would go on a run, the Cavs would go on another run to cut it down to 5 points until Steph just kind of went bonkers.
Yeah, unfortunately, I just think what it came down to was they maintained contact, which is all you're really supposed to do in Oakland. I mean, that's the game plan for every team when they go into Oakland is maintain contact, try to make a push late in the fourth, right?
Right.
And You know, there were a couple times, and I talked about this in kind of my post-game wrap-up. You know, there were just a couple times where the Cavs had opportunities to match Curry's explosion, where they generated good looks, but it's just really hard to match when you're a role player. It's really hard to match the best shooter of all time, shot for shot.
Yeah, and especially when some of those good looks are being taken from Jeff Green, where you have to question, okay, was this great offense that generated this good look, or is he open because he's Jeff Green?
Yeah, and in fairness, but a lot of these are good looks from JR or you know, guys that should make a couple.
I would agree. It wasn't just bad shooters being left open. The Cavs missed a lot of shots where they should have converted.
Green only took 2 threes.
And Kyle Korver, I think, passed up a few too many good looks.
Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately, like, it's not a sexy thing to say, but, like, in order to beat the Warriors, your shooters have to shoot a better-than-normal percentage. I think a good example is someone like P.J. Tucker, who had a great series shooting the ball in the Western Conference Finals for the most part, where, you know, when those shots are going in, you just suddenly have enough punch to hang during those explosive moments. And the Cavs haven't shot to their baseline, let alone above it.
Right.
And I just think that, like, that just completely decimates their chance to compete in the series.
Do you think some of that's road blues? Like, just
maybe. But you can't afford road blues when you're this much worse than the opposition.
Like, yeah.
I mean, I've said it a billion times. I'm sure people who regularly listen, whoever the hell you are, thank you. people who regularly listen are probably sick of me saying this, but like I always talk about playoff basketball in reference to margin for error, because I think that's actually the best way to kind of handicap a matchup. It's not just who's better, who's worse. It's who can get away with more bad things happening to them.
Because, and the Warriors' margin for error is impossibly large.
It's fucking enormous. Like, that's why – I think it was Jeff Nomina on Twitter who was just talking about how that's why when the Warriors do get a couple good calls, it feels so much bigger and more frustrating.
And that's why it stands out. Like, if they get away with a moving screen, it's always a conversion. If they get a call that goes their way, or if they cut LeBron's legs out and he falls down, it's not just that, oh, we didn't get a free throws there. They hit a corner three almost every time after they get a break.
Yep. So their capacity to take advantage of other people's errors and absorb their own is just unmatched, and the Cavaliers are the opposite, where every mistake they make, every flubbed switch, or for the love of God, every time Steph has to give up the ball, then quickly sprints to the corner and gets a wide open three, which please stop letting him do that. You know, like that stuff just feels particularly backbreaking, and I think it was in this game. But you know, in spite of all of that, they lost because Steph went fucking bananas.
Right.
He didn't have that good of a game from the field. He went 11 for 26. The Cavs actually did a much better job on him inside the arc. It could have been worse. But 9 threes, man, that's tough. And I think you never can overstate – excuse me. You can never overstate the emotional impact of a couple Steph threes, man.
No, that's the thing.
They hurt so bad.
And I know a lot of people going into game two thought this was going to be like the 40-point night from Kevin Durant, but it was instead the Warriors operating in their optimal mode, which is Steph Curry being a flamethrower and kind of being like the emotional leader of the team, and Durant just efficiently getting his shots within the flow of the offense. It was a little disappointing for me because I was kind of getting ready to make some jokes about the average difficulty of Durant's shots and him needing a point guard to get him going. But that opportunity went by, unfortunately. And yeah, game one is just so frustrating when you look back on it. I know Zach Harper made this joke and I love it, but you can't lose a 51 point game from LeBron, and you can't lose a 15 point game from George Hill. Like, those two feel like blown opportunities in both games, because you don't know how many times you're going to get that.
Yeah, I wrote up that game two to me felt like if the big battle at the end of Independence Day, they lost it, but then had to go fight again. It's like, kind of felt like we already gave it our best shot, but I guess we'll keep trying because we can't quit.
And it's funny, for all the hand-wringing over, oh, God. Like, there were more people tweeting about how they didn't care about this finals than there were people tweeting about the finals. But then game one is arguably one of the best games that we've got all postseason from any matchup. And I think the Cavs have actually put up a pretty good fight. It's just disheartening that, as you said, the margin for error is just so slim that you miss one or two open threes that you probably should have hit, or just a couple unforced errors. And then when you compound that with them just not getting any breaks with the officiating and the Warriors hitting, like Steph hitting those rainbow shots over Kevin Love and stuff like that, like it's just so hard to beat this damn team.
Yeah, and something I just can't get past, and I know the numbers don't really work with me here, and I just kind of don't care. It kills me that Kevin Love can't catch the ball with his left hand and can't shoot with his left hand right now.
Yeah.
Because he is getting overplayed on his left shoulder so fucking hard because they know he can't turn over his right one to put it up.
Yeah. Turns out playing with a torn ligament in your thumb can make things a little difficult to finish with it.
Yeah, especially like, you know, I get that it's his non-shooting hand, and that matters a lot less for guards. But post players have to score with both hands.
Yep.
And unless you're Al Jefferson, that is. But like, there have been so many plays, and I know Kevin Love has not historically shot well from the field, especially from two-point field goal range against the Warriors in past finals. But we saw him score pretty efficiently and be more dangerous around the rim against the Warriors in the regular season this year. And I think these Warriors are a little more vulnerable than past teams on the interior, and I'm not 100% sure why that is.
Because they have six centers and none of them can play.
That's fair.
And plus, Draymond just hasn't been as effective, whether that be...
Draymond hasn't been quite where he was, and I think the Cavs have done a better job at generating good looks for Love in the post as opposed to the normal just bang, 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 try to do a jump hook. Like he's gotten a
couple. Here's the ball,
go
make something happen.
Yeah, I think they've gotten a lot better at setting that corner screen set, that corner screen play where Hill and Love will do that dance along the baseline. Has generally created such good looks for Love. And there's just times where he just can't quite finish it, or here he has Steph sealed and he has to catch it with one hand because his left hand won't work. Like that stuff matters. And I just really am feeling that. I'm noticing it more because they need him more as a scorer. And, you know, maybe he's 10 of 18 instead of 7 of 18 tonight. And the whole game feels different. You know, it's hard to know, but I will not just accept that, oh, Kevin Love is not good against the Warriors, so it doesn't matter that he can't use his left fucking hand. I just can't accept that.
No, and he was actually fine against them last year in most of the games. And I think he was great in game one. I think he ended up having a very productive game two. I think he's made a bigger impact than most people would have
given. He should have.
Yeah, he's showed up and he's had an impact on the defensive end as well. Like I think he's had a really good series, and it is nice to see.
I'm fairly stunned by how well he's done on Durant switches.
Yeah, and some of that I feel like is Durant having a shoulder by him and then deciding to pull up for some reason. But still, it's the same thing as when he had the infamous stop there on Steph Curry. Like he was just. You play your position, you just kind of try to keep your body in front of a guy, and if they settle for a bad shot, then you did your job. Like, he's not Kawhi Leonard here, but he's going out there and he's making a legitimate impact. And I mean, there's been so much focus on whether or not this is kind of the end of this era, this version of the team, whether it be LeBron, Love, Tristan, all those guys. But it is nice to see at least that core showing up. JR hasn't exactly joined that core, but it's at least nice to see those three kind of if this is kind of the last battle with them. they're going down swinging, and that's a lot different than 2010, because I still remember them basically dribbling out the clock with a chance that maybe a miracle, but just deciding, you know what, we're done here.
Yeah. I've mostly been pretty proud of this team's effort. I think the next step here in looking forward is talking about the rotation, something that's been a very hot button topic on Twitter. I have two questions for you, Justin.
Okay.
And
that sounds overwhelming.
Related. They're both related to one another. So one answer will answer the other. Do you think that the Cavs should just go to an 8-man rotation?
No.
Or do you think that the Cavaliers should change their rotation by removing someone and adding someone else?
I think they should keep the rotation. I think they've actually gotten some decent minutes out of Larry Nance. I actually expect him to have at least one big game in Cleveland. We mentioned how the Warriors just aren't as intimidating on the inside defensively. And when they're playing Kevon Looney or Draymond at center or who any of their smaller options, those are situations where Larry Nance should be productive. I mean, as long as he's not kind of making mental blunders, he has an edge physically. He should have an edge against David West as well. Should be able to generate offensive rebounds. And I think it's important because realistically speaking, you're not in all likelihood going to win this series. I think letting him work through some of the stuff on this stage is important for his future, because I think he's one of the few pieces that we can kind of identify as being someone that they probably anticipate sticking around with the franchise. So I think it's important to keep getting him reps. I'd still be playing Tristan Thompson in the way that they've been playing him. Jordan Clarkson, I would probably remove out of the rotation for Jetty Osman. But I don't anticipate that being the case. But
holy shit, Jordan Clarkson had an assist last night?
Yeah, it broke.
Oh, I didn't catch that. I have the box score up. Sorry.
Yeah, Tom Haverstraw said that it broke a streak of, I think, like 154 consecutive minutes played without an assist. So, yeah, good for Jordan Clarkson. He turned a corner there, but I'd probably be taking him out of the rotation.
Yeah, I just don't think he's good enough to justify the additional like bullshit. Like, if his ball handling, I understand the idea. It's not inherently stupid.
Especially okay, when George Hill is getting a rough whistle. Like when he picked up those fouls in game one, that was pretty tough, and you needed to have a second ball handler out there because we've seen what the Warriors can do against LeBron defensively or how hard they can make him work when there isn't another ball handler. So that made a little bit of sense. But at the same time, if George Hill is still available, I would much rather have Jetty Osman out there.
Yeah, I just think at this point, when you're looking at the practical value added by his ball handling versus the theoretical value, the pendulum is far too swung to one side. And
theoretical Cavs are awesome.
Yeah,
man.
Theoretical Cavs are fucking great, man. But yeah, so like ultimately, like I'd just rather have a tall guy who works really hard and will run, sprint back in transition to maybe blow up some stuff, take a few Euro fouls if he needs to, just do little things.
Hang on, what's a Euro foul?
When you stop a fast break.
Oh, okay.
I
thought you were saying just because Jetty's European, no, and somehow his fouls are different.
No. Who do you think I am?
I don't know. You're weird.
I guess I'm a xenophobe all of a sudden. yeah, I don't know. I think Osman's not the worst idea. I mean, I don't think you can. I think JR, I think it's an interesting thing because JR is catching a ton of deserved flack for being terrible, but I'd rather take Clarkson out of the rotation than JR. But I'm not.
Oh, no. You have to hope that JR can be productive.
You just have to, at this point, because Rodney Hood just hasn't shown it, and he doesn't deserve it. He hasn't deserved the minutes, and I know JR doesn't either, but I think ultimately, if you're going down, you at least need to go down with the worst op, with the best of bad options that LeBron also happens to like.
Yeah.
I think
there's more likelihood that LeBron is going to make the pass to an open J.R. Smith than some of the other options.
That's actually a really good way to frame it.
He's not going to get Jay Crowdered.
Yeah, I'm not inherently opposed to going to an 8-man rotation of just Nance Green and Korver. I know that leaves you really guard deficient, but I think you can work ways around it. Doing some ultra big lineups, playing LeBron at point guard a little bit, staggering LeBron and Hill's minutes a little bit more. I don't know. Do you think that's the worst strategy? I mean, at this point, like, it's the NBA Finals. You might as well just go down and play the guys you trust till it's time to say goodbye.
Okay, well, if you're just playing the guys you trust, we're just basically rolling out LeBron, Love, and Tristan.
Well, Alabama nearly beat Minnesota this year playing 3-on-5, so we technically cannot rule it out.
I'm still just so upset that with that JR play that Nick Young wasn't out there to intentionally foul JR.
He would have, man.
100% Nick Young would have intentionally fouled JR there. And that would have just been the ultimate knucklehead moment of all knucklehead moments.
Yeah, it would have been knucklehead inception. though, given JR's free throw stroke, he probably would have just missed both of them.
God. You are such a negative dick.
Oh, come on. That was just a joke. I do think that the next step in the conversation here is because we just talked about rotation. We talked about how it's a bunch of bad options. And this is something I'm very interested in talking about, and I'm just not hearing it talked about. I'm even amenable to not being right on this, though I'm very rarely amenable to that. I'm amenable to not being right on this, but I cannot believe the conversation's not being had. People are raking Tyronn Lue over the coals on Twitter, and I'm not hearing anything about the roster that he's been given to work with. That has been proven deficient at every turn.
Yeah.
And I think it is fair to take stock of the job Kobe Altman has done as the GM.
Okay. I get where you're coming from, and I don't want to necessarily get into reruns on this. I think we're both on the same page, at least with the Kyrie Irving trade, that once they found out how bad Isaiah Thomas's hip was, that they should have nullified the trade, or at least said, we're not doing this until you include Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum. And I think I would have been willing to take a lesser package in favor of that, whether that be Malcolm Brogdon, Chris Middleton, and the Bucks first round pick, which would have been interesting to see what ended up happening with Milwaukee if Kyrie went down. But I think with the trades that were made at the trade deadline, the reason why those guys haven't worked out is basically more to do with the situation and the lack of continuity and chemistry than anything that Tyronn Lue has done as a head coach and anything that Kobe Altman could have foreseen. Because you had those guys coming in there with Kevin Love being out. So they're working with LeBron. So it's LeBron and young guys. We got an effing squad now. They go out, they run, they have some fun. And then Larry Nance gets hurt, and Rodney Hood gets hurt, and George Hill gets hurt. And you don't have any time together as a unit. Kevin Love comes back with 2 weeks left prior to the playoffs. George Hill is still out. And basically the first time that they had a fully healthy roster for a complete game was game one against Toronto. And I think Tyronn Lue hasn't done a great job, but at the same time, this team still did get to what their ceiling is, which is an NBA Finals appearance, when things looked a little sketchy at times. Like, I think Lou made good adjustments against Boston. I think that he came up with a good game plan that Toronto was just incapable of countering. So he does deserve some credit there. But ultimately, you look at Rodney Hood, for example, and there just hasn't been a role carved out for him. And sure, Lou should share some culpability in that. But at the same time, when when your time to experiment and to get the roster and rotation ironed out is all in the playoffs and you face elimination in the first round, you kind of have to just say, okay, we're putting your well-being and your ability to contribute to this roster on the back burner because I just need to go with whoever I know can get this done in this situation, because ultimately the team advancing is more important than the growth of Rodney Hood.
Yeah, I'm not criticizing Lou though. I'm criticizing,
but no. But my point,
who have no established track record of being good
enough.
But
here's my point.
We like the idea of these guys, but it's not like, I'm sorry, this comes back to my, I've said it multiple times. The reason I think Kobe Altman is not getting any criticism is because NBA Twitter liked the trades at the time.
I get that, but I still think those trades work out if they had more time together. And I think that's why Kobe Altman has gotten a little bit of a pass, is because if this team had a training camp together, or if this team even had a month together prior to that, I think these pieces actually would have worked. If Larry Nance never pulls his hamstring, I think Larry Nance, you saw it.
I think Nance has been fine.
What?
I think Nance has been fine.
Yeah, he's looked a little healthier recently, but I'm saying that he could have at least had a more major impact, because when he first came over to the team, he looked good. Rodney Hood, if he got out of his own head, I think could have an impact if he had a defined role.
Doesn't that matter that he's in his own head?
But him being in his own head to the extent that he is, I think is a product of not having a role for him, and I think that's not necessarily on Tyronn Lue, and that's not on Kobe Altman. It's just the reality of the situation that they've been thrown into here.
I get that, and I want to note that the problem with evaluating anything Altman did is that he started behind the eight ball in a terrible situation. But I think that it matters that the players he's added have not met expectations at every turn.
Right.
The only player that he's added that has been better than we thought he would be with the Cavs is Jeff Green.
I think that's fair to say.
Thomas sucked. Crowder sucked. Rose sucked. Hood has sucked. Clarkson sucked. It's not even that they're just mediocre. They've sucked.
How do you feel about it though?
That matters. It just bothers me, because I think that while we're raking Tyronn Lue over the coals for not playing guys that we don't even think are good, we're not going after the people who matter. And actually it goes back to Dan Gilbert, as it always does, for not re-signing the most successful GM in team history for no reason. Right. Putting an inexperienced GM behind the eight ball to make decisions he's never
had
to make.
But that's why he gets a pass. Like, I think we're both on the same page that Tyronn Lue hasn't done a great job this year, but it's not all necessarily his fault. And ultimately, this team still got to what their ceiling was. But he's always going to be a target. But I think when you're asking, why is Kobe Altman getting a pass, or at least not being talked about, I think it's because...
Yeah, I feel like we're not even evaluating him. That's what bothers me. We're not even evaluating his moves.
Right, but I think it's so much to do with the situation, and I think he's going to be evaluated more in the future. But when the season is still – or not – when the finals are still ongoing and the playoffs are still ongoing, you don't often – the reflection on the front office and the job that a GM does is typically more off-season talk. When you're seeing more about Tyronn Lue, it's talking about, let's make adjustments to get a game or two off the Warriors in the finals here. Like, I get that you want to look at the bigger picture, because I agree that that's more interesting. And if you're of the perception that the Cavs just don't have a chance against the Warriors and there was no chance of winning a title, that's the way that you would naturally go. But I think for a lot of fans, especially with how they played in game one, I think they talked themselves into the Cavs at least having a chance to make this a legitimate series. So that's going to be the focus, and that's why you don't see that conversation on your timeline.
I think that's definitely fair. I think game one very much impacted the way we've talked about this team. I just kind of want people to stop putting – I think I think we need to be better at acknowledging that Tyronn Lue doesn't have good pieces to work with right now. And I think we're getting there through blood, sweat, and tears and Twitter arguments.
But again, the conversation, like, that same point is being made. It's just phrased in a different way. It's that LeBron doesn't have any help, right? Like, yeah, that's not the way we're always going to discuss.
No one's saying Tyronn Lue doesn't have any help. I guess that's what's frustrating me.
Right, but for a lot of casual fans, they don't even view him as the head coach. So yeah,
it's like what Mort always says, and I think it's a really smart thing. Like, if Jose Calderon and Rodney Hood and Jetty Osman, who played like 4 minutes a game, are your answers, you need to think about the questions you're asking. That's all I want people to do.
Well, I mean, Jetty Osman, the only question that he could answer is who's the Cavs' next MVP, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and like, to be clear, I would probably play Jetty at this point. Like, I think we're both in agreement on this.
It's very shocking for this podcast to have a pro Jetty slant.
But it's just so weird. Like, the smugness of NBA Twitter has just been killing me recently. Like, it's just bothering me. Like, that we have all the answers, and if they just listen to us, and that's why it's stupid that it's bothering me, because that's always been that way.
Right. You're just annoyed because the Cavs are down, so you have a more acute sense of it.
Yeah, that's definitely what it is. But I am interested to see. I'll say this. I think we need to be very careful about giving Altman the benefit of the doubt this summer with the moves he makes, depending on how things play out.
Yeah, I don't think that he's going to get the benefit of the doubt. I think he's his time to be raked over the coals is coming up, and I think that it's – as young as he is, and as bad of a situation as this is, he's going to be thrown into a pressure cooker, and I hope that he's ready for it. I still think that the moves that he made ultimately were smart decisions based on the information that's been at least leaked publicly. But I mean, they just haven't panned out. And
you know what's interesting about him?
And you get graded on your results rather than your process, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting. What's interesting with him is that I think that he has simultaneously done a very good job at negotiating based on perceived value around the league. That's why NBA Twitter says, oh, we liked the trade. You know, like he has earned good trade grades, so to speak.
Yep, I would agree.
So I think he has a good sense of what people are valued at around the league and things like that. I think he has done a poor job at projecting fit and some intangible stuff. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's inexperience. It's really hard to tell, man. I think hard to evaluate. And like, I'm not calling for him to be fired. I don't want people to think that it's more about like evenly distributing blame as opposed to like wanting to completely shift blame.
And maybe me being an optimist and my ego getting in the way is a factor in how I'm looking at this.
That's what I think is happening.
No, you've made that point very clear, but I still ultimately think like that these pieces do make sense, and that's probably getting in my way when we're talking about how much culpability Kobe Altman should have here, because I still ultimately think that these pieces would work out, at least for this season. Obviously, if you are going to get LeBron to return, I don't think this roster can resemble too closely what it looks like currently. I think you have to make a little bit more of an appealing pitch, because there's going to be some appealing pitches out there. But ultimately, I still think that these pieces, given time, given a training camp, could work.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. And
fan bias is obviously weighing on that heavily, and I'm fully aware of that.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know. I can't get past that. I think another part of my frustration with it is that I'm a little mad at myself because I didn't listen to my favorite test, which is the opposing fan base that sad to see this guy go test.
Like, yeah,
Jazz fan were even wistful. There was no wist.
But see, I think why I didn't go on that test with Jazz fans is just because how much they hate every player that's leaving. Like, even Gordon Hayward, it's like, well, we didn't even need him.
Yeah, they didn't even love Rodney while he was there, though.
That's a fair point.
And you know, and then I also, I think being an optimist, I think I'm also mad at myself because I subjugated my idea that I didn't think Clarkson was good when they made the trade. And then a couple people, Damon Rangula.
I was going to say Damon shouldn't even count. You went off the test by asking Damon what he thought, and he thought Clarkson and Nance were going to be great.
Damon, but Damon's put not the even fucking full court press on Jordan Clarkson's not that bad on me, and I wavered, and now I feel like an idiot. I think that's part of why I'm so annoyed. I think I'm mad at myself too.
But there's voices that I respect that were saying that, oh, he's going to be good in this situation. Like even David Thorpe. Even David Thorpe
framed that like you don't respect Damon.
Well, I don't anymore, and you can't even give him the full Lakers fan pass because he's the one that wrote that LeBron is better than Kobe, which of course is true, but he's not. He's not a litmus test for what Lakers fans actually think.
Sad. It's just an interesting thing, and I do wonder. I mean, I'm still not like of the opinion that LeBron is 100% gone.
Oh, me either. And I probably put 60-40
that way. Need to maybe chill just a little bit. And I think that I think this is one situation where it's really, really nice for the Cavs that the NBA is structured the opposite of the NFL, where the draft comes first and then free agency opens.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it does functionally is it allows Kobe Altman the time to get groundwork in place to convince LeBron to stay. Like, they don't have to – like, they can conceivably come to LeBron with a plan – and say, hey, here's what we got. Can you give us any assurance? You know? And I really do think he'll work with them on that. You know, a lot of people are of the opinion that he's going to be completely intransigent and not help them at all. He's also not dumb, and he should also look to secure himself the best position possible.
You've already set yourself up as the man that hates Kobe Altman. I'm going to kind of, I don't know how it would contribute to your Kobe Altman hate, but I would say if LeBron stays, I don't know how much credit I would even give to Kobe Altman, because I think LeBron is going to be planning and networking with other players to make something happen. And Cleveland probably has a leg up because I don't think he wants to be viewed as like a Shaq-like mercenary where he's changing jerseys and cities towards the end of his career. So I think Cleveland's going to have a leg up in that sense that he's going to try to make something happen here. But ultimately, I think he's going to end up wherever he can create the best situation. So whether that be in Philadelphia or Houston, or if they trade away all the young guys on LA and build something that we just never would have expected there. Maybe that's possible. But I think wherever he ends up, that team is not going to resemble what they look like right now. I think that there's going to be significant and meaningful change to any roster. And that includes Houston, because that team would have to gut its roster in a lot of ways in order to make it possible for LeBron.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't know, but I also do think it's on Kobe Altman to some extent to go, at least get his side of the bargain done.
No, like, for sure. No, like I do get that. Even ask
LeBron to talk to Paul George and see if he'll do the opt-in, or talk to CJ McCollum, try to convince him to come back to Northeast Ohio, things like that.
Well, I think those conversations are both LeBron things.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying is, like, you can ask LeBron to do that, but you also have to have Kobe Altman working the phones, coming up with frameworks. You know, kind of like how they had to do with Kevin Love, for example. Like, they had to have a Kevin Love deal ready to get LeBron to come. Which there's just no way around it. And I think that's the kind of work that Kobe Altman needs to do this summer. Where if he can't do that, then it's all moot. Like, LeBron can only do so much. So I think that's where the advantage is. Because if you had to do this before the draft, before you know, the number eight pick had figured out what it was going to be. And, you know, before all of this, all of the draft stuff went down, I think it'd be really a much more of an uphill battle. And I think people are going to make the case, and they might be right, that it actually hamstrings the Cavs more to have the draft before, because they won't know what to do with the pick based on whether LeBron is leaving or not. My argument is, if they have any chance of keeping him, they'll know.
I would agree. And Brian Windhorst has said this a lot, that if LeBron is leaving this time around, it's not going to be just as a free agent. It's going to be a Chris Paul situation where he opts into the next year of his deal and the Cavs trade him. So
I wonder if Dan Gilbert will let his pride do that, barring an outrageous return.
Well, I mean, there has been some talk that Gilbert's ready to part ways as well. So I don't know how much stock I put into that, because
wouldn't that be great?
Wouldn't that be great? But ultimately, I don't really buy into it. I think that's just a lot of rumors and speculation, because I don't think Dan Gilbert wants that to happen to the value of his franchise.
Yeah, that's fair. I'll be interested to see what that would entail, because if it's Houston, for example, and LeBron says, I want to go to Houston. Mm-hmm. And the only way Houston really can do it organically is to do a sign and trade,
right?
Or an opt in and trade, to be clear, because sign and trades are different in the CBA. Boy, would you have to give me something great to make it worth my while to facilitate the move that can't be done any other way? Because that's the difference between his move to Miami in the first decision and this. Whereas Miami could have done it. They just would have had to make some tweaks.
They didn't have to give up all those firsts.
Houston would have a, frankly, uphill battle to do this. Especially with
the way LeBron operates, because it's, you have to clear the space and then I'll take a meeting with you.
Yeah. I would be very interested to see just how much the Rockets would have to give up, and it would have to be quite a bit, I think. But actually, it's worth considering that the Rockets' window was probably, with LeBron, if they got their whole roster to add LeBron, window would not be as long as you would think.
No. And I think there are legitimate questions to be asked of, can Chris Paul stay healthy? Because I think the last time Chris Paul stayed healthy for an entire playoff run, the Lakers were still viewing Andrew Bynum as a centerpiece of their future. So that car has a lot of mileage on it, and the clutch sticks.
Seven.
Yeah, and one of the brakes sticks on the tire randomly. Like, there's some concern there.
Yeah, I don't know. If I were LeBron, I would think long and hard about that one. I actually think if he's going west, I would probably rather just go to the Lakers and build my own team.
Yeah, but I'm sure this is the conversation people want right now.
Yeah, sorry, man. Didn't mean to. But it is interesting. I'm really looking forward to this summer, actually. Just from I'm not looking forward to it because it's going to be stressful, because it's going to stink if LeBron leaves. But from an interesting things happening standpoint, boy, is it going to be fun.
Yeah, there was a point there in Game 7 against Boston where when the Cavs were down 12 there, the rationalizing and all the thinking of, you know what, like maybe I'd be okay with the post-LeBron era and things like that. All of my thinking and trying to prepare myself just completely went out the window, and I'm like, I'm not ready for this to end at all.
That made that whole series, the stress of that whole series, worth it for me to hear you say that.
I was always on the I don't know how I would think bandwagon. I was like, I think part of me is okay with it, part of me isn't. But yeah, that kind of made it clear that I was like, you know what, I'm not 100% ready for that by any stretch of the imagination. And it's going to make this summer very stressful. I am looking forward to it because I just want answers.
That'll be nice. Clarity is always nice.
Yeah, and I think I'd be able to rationalize anything and be able to get some enjoyment out of anything. Yeah, obviously, option one and the preferred thing is what is going to happen, which is Chris, Paul George, and CJ McCollum joining the Cavs.
It has been ordained. But before we wrap up, I do think we should look forward in this series. Because the Cavs are going back to Cleveland. They've been very, very good in Cleveland during these playoffs. I think they can win game three. And if they win game three and somehow steal game four, all of a sudden, you know, we're going to be back, baby.
I'm fairly confident about game three. I think game three is your classic Warriors take their foot off the gas game. They took care of business at home. Game one, they fucking stole, which is still painful. But I think in game three, you're going to see the Cavs shooters actually hit shots, which has been a big difference once again in this series, is not hitting shots on the road. I think you get a motivated LeBron. He doesn't want to be swept. George Hill has played a whole lot better at home, and I think him actually having a strong game two sets a good foundation for him playing well for the rest of the series, or at least in these two games in Cleveland. I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic heading into these Cleveland games.
Hey, I have a question, and it's going to come off as sacrilege, but I don't want it to because it's not actually negative. Did you feel LeBron pacing himself a little bit more in game two?
I don't think he paced himself. I think there were a few moments where he was emotionally like just exhausted.
There's something to that. But I think that's a good indicator for game three is what I'm saying.
Oh, I think it's a great indicator for game three. Like, I think when he was undercut there and he didn't get a call and you look up and the Warriors are hitting a three on the other end, like, I think there was just moments where he was, like, spiritually broken there. Because
he was
very good in game two.
I don't want to say he was bad, but, like, he wasn't otherworldly, and this series requires he be otherworldly.
Yeah, I think there were definitely moments where he was just kind of looking at his teammates, looking at the Warriors, like, looking at the score and being like, well, shit, like we're not getting the breaks. This is not our night. And
yeah,
I do think that he played a very good game. He just wasn't 51 point. Oh, my God, this is one of the best performances we've ever seen on the final stage. Good.
Yep, and you felt that difference ultimately, especially finishing around the rim. That's where I kind of felt his lack of burst, where he was just like that.
Well, some of that was also they were just fire. They were fouling him.
yeah, he got fouled a lot. But you know, that's just the way it goes. I actually feel pretty optimistic for Game Three as well, and I think that it's kind of nice that the Warriors pulled out so many stops in Game Two that weren't just Steph going nuclear. They did a lot of cool, interesting things offensively that the Cavs now have some tape on.
I think that's a really good observation.
And hopefully, Cavs were blindsided with those slips. I mean, completely. They were like, holy shit, what are we even doing out here? And I think having
which might feed it to people's. Oh my God, my voice went there. That was a fucking nightmare. That might feed into people's criticisms of Tyronn Lue, because most of Twitter was like, well, they're going to be slipping those screens with JaVale McGee out there. Like, I think that was something almost everyone saw coming.
Yep. And they weren't ready for it ultimately. And they should be now. And if they're not in game three, well, it was a nice 4-game series. But I thought they did a better job over the course of the game, too, ultimately. I'm interested in seeing how the Cavs bounce back in game three. They have a couple days off. And I think they're going to be energized at home. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong. It's not like I don't know if the Cavs will even be favored in game three.
I don't think they will be.
They're still dogs. But I think they have a very good chance to win this game.
Yeah. The Warriors were a 12-point favorite at home. I don't think that swings to the Cavs being a favorite just because of home court advantage.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know, man. I just don't think – I think there is a reality, and this is why game one hurts so bad, is because when the Warriors' backs are against the wall, they have never responded particularly well.
I would agree with that, and that's what I was hopeful in game two, where it's like, wow, it feels like the Warriors should be up a whole lot more than they are, and the Cavs are really battling here. Maybe this 5 points turns into like 2 points late in the fourth quarter, and you have another chance to steal one. But obviously that didn't happen, because Steph Curry with the 10-point lead is basically impossible to beat.
Yep, but if the Cavs go win game three and four at home, hold serve, you know, it suddenly becomes conceivable. Still very, 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 very unlikely. But it's conceivable, so we have to let this series play out. I'm not all the way ready to concede it, even though it's pretty much, you know, it's probably like Cavs probably have like a 5% chance at this point, if that. But
the thing I do appreciate
is have LeBron.
Well, yeah, I do appreciate having LeBron. That certainly helps. I also am appreciative. I like what the Cavs are doing here, where they let the Warriors get two wins just so that there's no possibility for a 3-1 lead. Because more than anything, I fear the karma of those jokes. So the Cavs did what they needed to do to prevent that possibility.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, that seems like a good place to wrap it up. Hopefully the Cavs hold serve and extend this series, because I would like to see more of LeBron James on my team. And we at least are guaranteed to have him for these finals. So hopefully they hit their shots. Hopefully George Hill plays well. Hopefully Jetty Osmond maybe gets some burn, although I'm not optimistic. But thank you so much to our listeners. I hope that you guys are dealing with these finals well. And I would encourage you to just try to get as much enjoyment as possible and not dwell on the losses, because ultimately this has been a fantastic era of Cavs basketball. And while it's not necessarily over, I think that putting proper appreciation for what we've got to see is important. So thanks to our listeners. Remember, support the show. Leave a rating. Leave a review. Subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe, and tell your friends and family about the podcast. Let's help this thing grow. So thanks again, and until next time, go Cavs.